This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Yeah, sanity, a fine thing it is. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, the Republican debate. We will get to that in the second hour of the program. A fascinating op-ed in today's Financial Times from Gordon Brown. I want to share with my thoughts on that with you and what it means for the global economy. But first, it's Friday, and as we've done for going on 5 years now, maybe going on 6 years, I'm not sure. The first hour.
It's been a long time.
It has been, Bernie. God bless you. It has been. Our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, is the independent Senate, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, the independent senator from Vermont. Prior to that, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives, sanders.senate.gov, his website. And there's a great newsletter that Bernie sends out. I recommend you get over there and sign up for it. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom. I missed you the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, last week Louise and I were in London for our 35th wedding anniversary, and the week before that, you were in Africa.
I was in Africa. Let me briefly, during the break, Congress just came back to work on the Senate came back to work on Tuesday. I was in Africa. We went to Morocco, we went to Ghana and the Ivory Coast, and I went with Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa and Representative Elliot Engel of New York State. Mm-hmm. The reason was to deal with an issue that I've long been involved in, that is child labor. And we took a look in Morocco at a very positive program. The Congress has allocated money to keep kids who formerly were working with child laborers and are now in school. And Tom, you know, I'll tell you something. It was just an enormously gratifying sight to see these kids who otherwise would have been working in factories or in fields, boys and girls, just so excited about being in school. Mm. And it just gives you an inkling of what the United States could do if we set our mind to do it.
Yeah.
And the people, they were so appreciative. And when you talk about fighting terrorism in a Muslim country, believe me, these people are very appreciative that the United States wants to help educate their kids. So it was a very, very good experience. Then we went to both the Ivory Coast and Ghana. We saw something quite a bit different. The purpose of the trip there was to take a look at how chocolate is made. You know, as you know, chocolate comes from cocoa beans.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that the people who make those cocoa beans in Ivory Coast, in Ghana, are paid horrendously low sums of money for their product.
Yeah, there's a small industry of fair trade chocolate, but it's a very small industry.
Well, it needs to grow. I mean, We're looking at people who maybe make $500 a year working very, very hard. So the immediate goal was to emphasize that we don't want to see children who should be in school working on cocoa farms, doing dangerous work, being exposed to pesticides, using machetes, carrying very, very heavy loads. We're beginning to make a little bit of progress there, but I think the time is long overdue for us to take, when we talk about the global economy, a hard look at the fact that a company like Mars Candy is a family that is worth billions and billions of dollars, and the people who produce their product make perhaps $500 a year. So
they've also been major funders of the call it the death tax.
You got it.
Program.
They have helped. They have been some of the leaders in making sure that the richest families in this country avoid paying the estate tax. Exactly right. And a lot of their profits are coming from exploiting some of the poorest people in the world. And that was an eye-opening and very interesting experience. Then a week later, just 10 days or so ago, I was in Immokalee, Florida. And I don't know how many of the listeners are familiar with what goes on with how the tomatoes that they eat, or the tomatoes that come into the fast food restaurants, McDonald's, Burger King, Pizza Hut, and so forth, where they come from. But in the wintertime, they come from an area called Immokalee, Florida, which is maybe a half hour away from Naples, Florida. And the workers there are probably the most exploited workers in our country. When you talk about the race to the bottom, I found the bottom in Immokalee, Florida. And what goes on is these workers are paid roughly 45 cents for a 32-pound basket of tomatoes. Very hard work, often under very bad conditions, sun very hot and so forth. You're bending all of the time. And these workers end up making $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 a year. The housing conditions at Immokalee in many cases were just atrocious. You see, I saw 8-10 workers living in a trailer, each paying $50 a month, getting ripped off, just horrible housing and paying a whole lot for it. Healthcare is hard to come by in that area. Every morning at about 5:30 in the morning, these workers go out to an area, a parking lot, where they wait for buses to come, and sometimes they get picked to work, sometimes they don't get picked to work. In fact, ironically, and if you don't get picked to work, you don't make any money at all because everything is piecemeal. If the crew leader doesn't like you, you're not going to get picked. There is a, ironically, when I was there, there was the Bush administration, if you can believe it, actually issued an indictment against some people there for slavery charges. Slavery.
Wow. In the United States of America.
In the United States of America in 2008. And this is not the first instance of slavery. These are people, in some cases, who have to bust their way out of a truck where they were being held against their will and being forced to work against their will. There have been a number of slavery cases within this industry. The goal now, there is a very good group, wonderful group there, called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIW, working hard to improve wages and working conditions there. They have negotiated agreements with the Yum Company, which owns Pizza Hut, which owns Kentucky Fried Chicken and some other fast food places, to pay a penny a pound more to workers, which would mean about a 60-65% increase in wages for these workers. Those companies have agreed to do that. Burger King has been resistant, but I'm beginning to hear some remarks from Burger King which suggest they might be prepared to do the right thing. We hope that they will. Bottom line is the conditions down there are deplorable, and they impact not only those workers, of course, mostly those workers, they impact all of us.
Yeah.
Because you're living in a culture where anybody can be treated the way these people are treated, then it affects every worker in America. So I hope people will pay attention to that issue and make sure that those people who pick the tomatoes for us get paid decently.
Yeah, indeed. Slavery in America, it's amazing. And so, I mean, so many people, frankly, in the working class in America are not that far from slavery.
That's right.
You know, when you could lose your health care if you change jobs and you have a pre-existing condition and you're just...
Well, that's what I mean. There's a culture out there now which is so horrendous, so anti-worker. This is the bottom of the bottom. But just to tell you another story, last week in Vermont, in northern Vermont, St. Albans area, I attended a meeting of workers who process a lot of the immigration forms that come in. Bush, not Bush, but before Bush, that industry, that work had been privatized. It used to be federal employees doing that work. It's been privatized. One company recently got the contract, and for many of the workers who were doing the work, their wages were lowered, $2 an hour lower. So they're trying to form a union, and we're working with them. But I think the point is that all over this country, whether it is the bottom of the bottom, which is, say, tomato pickers or Immokalee, Florida, or people who are doing immigration work in St. Albans, Vermont, and from coast to coast, there is enormous pressure on workers now who are seeing, in many instances, wage cuts, loss of health care, loss of pensions. People are working longer hours just to pay the bills. And we have got to take action, strong action, to reverse these economic trends, because if we don't, as bad as it is, it will continue to get worse, and our kids, for the first time in the modern history of America, will have a lower standard of living than we do. Which then takes us to where we are right now, and the issue that the Congress is now dealing with is this so-called stimulus package. The House leadership worked out an agreement with the Bush administration and the Republicans in the House, which had I think, some good things, but we've got a long way to go, and I intend to be working with people like Ted Kennedy and Tom Harkin here to significantly improve the stimulus package. As it stands now, lower-wage workers who, under the first Bush proposals, would have gotten nothing, will get only half in terms of a rebate of what middle-income workers will get. And we want to make sure that all of our workers get at least a $600 check, regardless, especially paying attention to the lower-income people.
Your phone calls for Senator Bernie Sanders. 866-303-2270 here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Nothing on but the radio. Feel the music playing soft and slow.
Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website, ours, tomhartman.com. However you spell it should get you there. You can get into our live chat room. Also, there's blog and chat over at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270, toll-free all across the United States, and you can dial into it from all around the world. And Bernie, ready to take some phone calls?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's see here. Phil in Cleveland, Ohio, you are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Phil.
My question is, are these workers, are they American citizens, or are they documented workers that are allowed to be here, or are the, what percentage of these people?
Well, that's a good question, Phil, and I don't know that anyone knows the answer. Some of them certainly are undocumented. Some of them are documented. Many of them come from Mexico, Guatemala, and from Haiti. And from, not from Haiti, but from, yeah, from Haiti. Those are the groups of people. What I can tell you is that when you talk about illegal immigration, the issue here is one of the concerns that many of us have about illegal immigration is the knowledge that these people are, in a sense, welcome into this country in order to be exploited. That's their function.
Yeah, and that's been, you know, ever since Reagan's great amnesty program, the wink and nod thing ever since then has been, yeah, come on in, and then but we've got the stick we'll hold over your head. And it's a tough one. It's a really tough one. Chip in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Chip?
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah.
I have a question for Senator Sanders.
Yes.
There seems to be a consensus that the biggest bang for the buck would be an extension of unemployment benefits. Why isn't that part of the package?
Well, Chip, that's an excellent question, and that is exactly what some of us will be proposing here in the Senate. As you know, the agreement reached in the House leadership and the White House were just tax rebates. And I think if those tax rebates are geared toward the middle class and lower income people, I think that makes a lot of sense. But in addition to that, we are going to have to extend unemployment benefits to make sure that those workers who are running out of their unemployment will be covered. I think we want to include food stamps. Hunger in America is growing. We're going to make sure that people, in fact, are able to buy the food that they need. I think we want to also increase funding for the LIHEA program, low-income heating assistance program for weatherization. So you're absolutely right, and that is an issue that some of us will be working very hard on here in the Senate.
Obie in La Crosse, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Senator Sanders, honored to talk to you. I'm a member of the Green Party, and for years there's been this frustration, not only at the presidential level but at lower levels, of the barriers to third parties and independents getting into office. But there you sit. I was fairly young when you were first elected, so I'm curious for your take on what's the Bernie Sanders model for getting independents into Congress.
Well, I think you're right. I think there are a number of states, not Vermont, but there are a number of other states which really put up barriers which are really unfair, and I think people have got to work on that. In a democracy, to get elected, you should not have to be just part of one of the two major parties. I think what I have tried to do in Vermont, running and succeeding as mayor of Burlington in the U.S., then in the U.S. House of Representatives, and then in the Senate, the message that I have brought forth to my state is that we have got to stand together to create a kind of society that works for all people and not just for the very wealthiest amongst us. And what I have tried to do is reach out to different groups of people to bring people together, to not the fact that somebody may disagree with somebody else on an issue like abortion or gay rights or even the environment. That's important. But by and large, most of us have common interests. We all want to see health care exist for all of our people. We all want decent paying jobs, and we don't want to see our jobs go to China. We all want our kids to have good education, including a college education, including a child care. We all want to make sure that the environment is clean. So what I've tried to do is develop themes that bring people together and say, look, there may be some issues where people disagree, and that's the way the world goes. But ultimately, certainly on economic issues, there is something very wrong when we're the only country in the world without, in the industrialized world, without a national health care program. We have the most unfair distribution of wealth and income. We have a shrinking middle class, an increase in poverty, a growing gap between the rich and everybody else. Those are issues that we should be able to bring people together on. It. That's the message that I've been talking about for many years in the state of Vermont.
Bernie, we just have 20 seconds before the break, so I don't want to bring a caller on, but I just your thoughts on those issues in the stimulus package. How do we get more structural changes in a stimulus package?
Well, we're going to have to the Senate is going to have to be very, very aggressive in telling the president that our economy faces huge problems. We can't ignore the issue of hunger. We can't ignore the issue of people being cold or losing their unemployment benefits. So there has to be a lot of grassroots effort for us to succeed.
Yeah, so we need to be communicating with our elected officials.
Absolutely.
As always. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, sanders.senate.gov. His website, ours, tomhartmann.com. 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Now back to the Tom Hartmann Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Fire it up, fire it up. We push off, we're rolling boulders, crashing down the mirrored stairways to a blast.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 1-866-303-2270 to talk to Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And Jeff in Denver, Colorado, listening on 760 AM. Hey, Jeff, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Bernie, I love your show. It's interesting that that you touched on this subject of the cocoa. I used to be a Snickers holic until I found out that the Mars Corporation was basically using slave labor, child slave labor, to pick the chocolate, and I had to stop, go to some other. Now I'm a picky chocolate eater. But staying on the world stage there, the European court has found that Karl Rove had something to do with an assassination to cover up the killing of 190 Palestinians by Ariel Sharon. I'm just curious what you can tell me about that, and I'll hang up and listen to you off the air.
Jeff, I'm afraid I can't tell you anything about that. I'm just not aware of that at all.
Yeah, I am unfamiliar with it myself. Randy in New York City on WWRL. Hey, Randy.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I don't know if either of you know the answer, but with the economic crisis and everything, and the cost of the war and then the cost of the occupation, I've been wondering for a while, what exactly is the cost? Where does the money go? Is it going to soldiers' salaries? Is it going to building tents? Is it going to the weapons that get exploded and unused?
Well, gee, Randy, you're asking a very good question. What I can tell you is the estimate is that we're now spending about $12 billion, that's with a B, $12 billion every month on the war. And obviously, when we have people like McCain telling us that we may be there for dozens and dozens and dozens of years, no one can begin to figure what the final cost of this war is, but there are some estimates now that it will range to the tune of $2 trillion. But what you should be aware of, Randy, is it's not just that we're spending a huge sum of money on the war, by the way, which is not paid for, just a debt that our kids and grandchildren are going to have to pick up. The military budget itself, above and beyond the war, is also exploding. And I think the question that we have to ask is, in my view at least, international terrorism is a very serious issue. I think that Bush has done a very poor job in combating that. In fact, in many ways, he's made the situation worse, as we're seeing now in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. But it is a serious problem, and it has to be dealt with. The question is, what is the relationship between nuclear submarines, aircraft carriers, and very sophisticated weapon systems in terms of the fight against terrorism? And to my belief, a lot of what we're spending really is a continuation of the efforts we made against the Soviet Union, which was, of course, a great military power. Al-Qaeda is not a great military power. They are very dangerous, but they have to be fought in a very different way. But I think we've got to begin to rethink a lot of how we're spending money on the military and who the supposed enemy is. If it's China, well, we have a trade policy with China, which is providing them with a lot of technology. Is it Russia? Who is it?
Yeah.
Who is it that we are arming ourselves against? Because a lot of these weapons are not designed to fight Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, good point. Max in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
My question is, what comes after, and nobody talks about this, but what comes after the $800? How do we solve, what's the long-term solution going to be? Because we have heard since Ronald Reagan that government was evil, and big government is a bad, bad thing. But every time somebody like Bush runs our country into the ground or our economy into the ground, the solution is this big, bad government.
That's right. Now, Max, that's a very good point. That is a very good point. Government is terrible until you need the government to bail you out. We also saw that, of course, in terms of the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates very substantially in order to stem the hemorrhaging of the stock market. I think, in my view, we need very systemic changes in economic policy. We need to move away from the Reagan-Bush neoliberal or neoconservative approach, however you may call it, which is trickle-down, which is designed to give tax breaks to the wealthiest people and the largest corporations, which is designed to push very aggressively an unfettered free trade agreement, which allows corporate America to throw American workers out on the street, go to China and other low-wage countries and bring their products back into this country. And I think we've got to replace that with a policy that says that in a democratic, civilized society, government has a very important role to play to make sure that, for example, everybody in this country has health care as a right of citizenship, and we end this absolutely horrendous system that we have, which is so wasteful, so bureaucratic, and leaves 47 million people uninsured. That's what we have to do. We have to change our trade policies that says to corporate America, how about building plants in Vermont and in America rather than just in China? We need labor law that says that it is important that workers be able to form a union if that's what they want to do without harassment from their employers. We need policies which say that global warming is a major international crisis, and government should play an important role in moving us toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And in the process, by the way, creating large numbers of good-paying jobs. For those people like Reagan and Bush who talk about how terrible government is, all they're really saying is they want power to rest in the hands of large multinational corporations. I just mentioned a moment ago a very large military budget. Check it out. See where the money is going to. See who the corporations are, relatively few, who are making huge sums of money building weapon systems that we may not even need. So I think we need to rethink some very basic tenets of our approach to the economy.
Debbie in New Mexico, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Did you say Debbie?
I did. That's you.
Hi. Good morning, Tom and Senator Sanders. My comment slash question is regarding the tax rebates. Yesterday on Tom's show, I heard a gentleman commenting on how he would be using his rebate to pay his credit card bills. I had been thinking the same thing, and I wonder if these tax rebates would really be a funneling of money back into the credit card companies and banks. And I personally would much rather see a package that would have long-term benefits, like direct the money into R&D for alternative energy, which would benefit everybody over the long term.
Well, the theory behind a stimulus package is you got to move the money out into the economy very, very quickly. Even if you are going to be paying off your credit card debts, that will leave you a little bit freer to be spending money in other areas. Generally speaking, I think what the economists tell us is that tax rebates that go to lower income and middle income people, that those people are more likely to spend it than upper income people. But also, spending which goes to infrastructure, weatherization, for example. We can put people to work right now retrofitting the homes of lower income people because the program already exists, but it is underfunded. We can put people to work immediately doing that. You kill a number of birds with one stone because the lower income people then save money on their heating bill. We have new jobs being created, and we move a little bit forward in reversing global warming by stopping greenhouse gas emissions. God only knows that there's a huge infrastructure problem in this country. We need hundreds of billions of dollars to address that, but we can start right now by putting money into bridges, into roads, into culverts. There are plans in 50 states in this country all right now ready to put people to work improving those facilities. So the goal is to get the money out, get it spent, get the economy stimulated.
Bird in Manhattan, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Is that me?
That's you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear my name called. Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you, Bernie Sanders, for all the work you've done in the past and I hope in the future. But you are aware of and that most of the people you're talking to are aware of all the deficits in governance that's going on now, all the things that have happened to make our democracy more fragile and our people poorer. In the light of the voting record of the Democratic Party in the last 12 months, the significant thing is, my question is really more rhetorical, how can I keep voting for a Democratic candidate in the light of these systemic failures in the party?
Well, Bert, I think the answer is that people who are serious about politics understand that the struggle is a long-term struggle. I know there are people who tell me, for example, that they're disappointed that the Democratic candidates for president aren't as progressive as they might be, and I share that concern. But on their worst day, any of the three major candidates will be infinitely better than Bush is on his best day. Are we in better shape today in terms of policies in Congress than we were a year ago when the Republicans had the House, the Senate, and the White House? We sure are. Right now, for example, we're talking about the stimulus package. If Bush had his way, workers making less than $25,000, people most indeed would not get a nickel of the rebate. And I hope that here in the Senate we could make the package negotiated in the House a lot stronger and more progressive. We
really
raised the minimum wage.
Isn't it a step, though, beyond just voting? I mean, we've reached the point now where it's not enough to just vote. People have to start getting active.
Absolutely. 300 million people have a lot of power. It is not just voting. You're absolutely right. We should be active 24 hours a day.
Yep. We're talking
12 months a year. Absolutely.
There you go. That's, you know, democracy is a 24-7 job.
That's right.
We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program, 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. The time is now, the way is clear. To rise up this year. Big time to vote. Ah, yes, time to vote. We got the South Carolina primary coming up. A whole lot more. Welcome back. Listener-supported radio supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. including SEIU 1199, the 200,000 health and hospital workers. They're fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. 1-866-303-2270. Jerry in Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Actually, good afternoon. I'm in the East Coast, so it's now afternoon.
Yep.
I'm calling with a few different points. So if I sound frustrated, obviously it's not at you, it's at our country's situation. Currently, between Senator Clinton and Obama, there is this political infighting that just is, to me, a cancer within the Democratic Party. And let me also state that I'm a recovering Republican for the last three or four elections. I kind of consider myself now a middle-of-the-road American and do away with the labels. But no one's pointing out that, you know, the Clintons are making all this noise and creating this huge hubbub about nothing, not addressing any issues, as well as Senator Obama. And where were they when our country was being hijacked by these guys in power now, the Bush administration?
Well, Jerry, you raise, I think, an important point in fairness to the candidates. The media very often loves to exaggerate, it loves to focus on conflicts and personal attacks and all that stuff. But I think your point is very important. And what we must demand of the media and the candidates is not personal attacks, but a focus on the real issues facing the American people. Why is the middle class in America shrinking and poverty increasing, for example, despite an increase in worker productivity? What are the moral ramifications, in my view, an issue that should be discussed, of having the most unfair distribution of wealth and income, where the richest 1% earn far more than the bottom 50%? These are issues that we've got to talk about. Why are we the only country in the industrialized world without a national health care program? So I think your point is well taken, but in fairness to the candidates, because I've been through this myself as a candidate, media tends and loves these types of personal attacks and conflicts. Sometimes they blow them out of proportion. But bottom line is the American people have got to demand real discussion about real issues and analysis of why we are where we are and how we are going to move forward in a very, very different direction than the Bush administration has taken us.
Douglas in Mesa, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, Bernie, how's it going?
Good.
Yes, I was just reading on Jonathan Turley's blog on page 6, in case everybody wants to go to, you know, South Korea, I believe, just expanded their Supreme Court to 14, and he was just wondering about expanding our Supreme Court to 19, which would make the members being appointed more current with how the country's progressing. And also, it would make it harder for any political party to, stack the court.
Hmm. This is something FDR tried without success.
Believe me, without success.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing, it's an issue that's worth discussing. But I don't have any magical thoughts on that.
Yeah, I don't know of any legislation that affects. Muammer in New York City, WWRL. Hey, Muammer.
Good morning, Tom. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Hello, Senator Sanders. How are you today?
Good.
My comment is on the assault on the American worker, starting with something I know very well about, which would be the situation in Michigan, my home state. There's complete assault on the American worker. Unions are being forced to disband.
Right.
Factories closing. Workers being disenfranchised of all their rights. And it's just incredible. People losing jobs, plants closing, for sales lines at home. Who is going to address this situation, sir, about this complete assault on unions? I'll hang up, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much for your thoughts, and you are exactly right. This is an issue that does not get the attention that it deserved. There's an assault on working people, on the middle class. There are a lot of reasons for why what is happening in Michigan, but let me tell you, it's not just Michigan. It is all over this country. We are rapidly deindustrializing. We're losing jobs in the automobile industry, have lost jobs in the steel industry, losing good-paying jobs all over this country. One of the reasons, not the only reason, is, to my view, a very disastrous trade policy which was pushed on Congress by corporate America, which said, look, unfettered free trade is the way to go. The result of that has been that companies are shutting down all over this country, moving to developing countries where they're paying people 50 cents an hour, 75 cents an hour, and then they can bring their products right back into this country. The demand has got to be to corporate America is that if you want us to buy your products, you'd better start manufacturing those products in this country. There is something wrong when a company like Walmart, low wages, low benefits, vehemently anti-union, is now the largest employer in America, whereas 25, 30 years ago, General Motors was the largest worker. Good wages, good benefits, strong union. That's the transition of the American economy. So I think trade is one of the areas. Protecting workers' rights to join unions and have unions is another very important point. The House and the Senate, both with majority votes, passed legislation which would make it easier. It's called the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yeah, card check.
Make it easier for workers to form unions. We couldn't get the 60 votes we needed in the Senate to end the Republican filibuster. But right now it is very difficult for workers to form unions because employers in many cases are acting illegally. They have the support of a right-wing labor relations board, and that's an issue that we've got to address. So we've got to reindustrialize America, create decent-paying jobs here, and make sure that workers can form and maintain their unions.
And that's a true stimulus package.
That's right.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Check it out. Sign up for his newsletter. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of England, has some thoughts on the international economy. I'll tell you about that right after this.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. Here's the question of the day, of the week, of the year, of the century. Actually, it's been the question since the founding of this country. And that is, to whose benefit do our political and economic systems accrue? Why do we create democracies? Why do we create nation states? Why do we create rules of economies? In other words, say, for example, that we're going to actually provide a benefit to a business to create a corporation. If I create a corporation, I can deduct things from my taxes that I can't create if I don't create the corporation. Healthcare, for example. Even some meals, travel, things like that, that as an individual I couldn't do, but I could do as a corporation. Why do we do that? Why do we give these benefits to companies? Well, the reason, by and large, is because we want companies to engage in economic activity to increase prosperity. But here's the kicker, here's the rub. When it becomes absolutely transnational and there's no consideration of local needs or national needs, then what you end up with is basically an aristocracy, a kingdom. You end up with a ruling elite, which is a small number of very, very powerful corporations who basically rule the world. They end up ruling the world. You look at, in the last hour, we were talking with Senator Bernie Sanders, and he was talking about international trade. 50%, more than 50% of all international trade right now is within companies. That is, within the same company. A company in the United States builds a factory in China, manufactures a product there, ships it back to the United States, and sells it as its product. That's more than half of world trade. In other words, it's really not trade. What it really is the outsourcing of jobs. It's really just searching the world for cheaper labor or cheaper resources. So Gordon Brown, in today's Financial Times, wrote an op-ed piece. Gordon Brown is very highly regarded in the United Kingdom. He's the prime minister. He's the guy who replaced Tony Blair. He's a brilliant student at, I believe he went to Oxford. People have very high regard for his intellect. He's thought of as being dreadfully boring, but a very smart guy. And this piece that he wrote is almost spooky because it shows an insight into this internationalist perspective that is just absolutely naked. I mean, keep in mind the Financial Times, this is the richest of the rich talking to the richest of the rich. And therefore, it's perhaps most enlightening. The article, his op-ed is titled Ways to Fix the Financial System. And in it, he writes, and I'm just going to share a couple of pieces of this with you, and then my perspective on it. He says, while financial flows, and therefore risks, have crossed borders effortlessly and reside in global companies. You get this? I mean, he's essentially coming right out and saying, okay, it's the global companies who really control the world. While financial flows and therefore risks have crossed borders effortlessly and reside in global companies, their supervisors and regulators are largely national. In other words, it's individual countries that are making the rules of business. He says, so the world still has no effective early warning system and still no common approach to handle major global market disruptions. Many of the problems were identified in advance but were not acted upon. We need a clearer, more authoritative watchdog. Regulators need to be enabled to overcome their boundaries. That would be their nation. With common principles, shared analyses, and information and collaborative management of crisis. And then he goes on to suggest that this should be the job of the International Monetary Fund. He said the IMF should act with the same independence as a central bank, responsible for the surveillance of the world economy, for informing and educating markets, and for enforcing transparency through the system. I mean, basically what he is saying is this is going to be the best thing for the multinational corporations. This is going to be the best thing for the world economy to just say, countries don't matter anymore. It just, it doesn't count what happens in individual countries. Well, this is, to some extent, there actually may be a little bit of truth to this, to a small group of very rich nations. But if it were to be truly international, and all 6 billion people in the world, it not only would it not help the poor countries, it would devastate the middle, the developing, and the developed countries. He goes on to say, the global activities of hedge funds and private equity are leading to fearful protectionist reactions, and sometimes, too, are foreign takeovers. In other words, how dare we be concerned? Well, first of all, he's pointing out a very real problem, and that is that these hedge funds and these traders and whatnot are able to work across national borders and basically scam and riff the system, and there's no regulation for it. But then he also, and is talking about foreign takeovers. It's like, we shouldn't be worried about the fact that, the French own the British water supply. I think the French and the British have had a few problems over the years. Apparently, they think they never will again. Or that, so much of our technology in the United States has now been outsourced that we can't build weapon systems. We can't build a destroyer or a missile without parts from China. What's wrong with that picture? Anyhow, Gordon Brown thinks there's nothing wrong with that picture. He said all these fears only underline the need for an open, free-trading global economy. He says without the globalization we've already enjoyed, world trade would not have grown twice as fast in the past 3 years than it averaged in the past 3 decades. And the price of our clothes and computers would not have halved in the last 10 years. So his argument, and this is the argument that's made by these globalists, is that, well, we brought you cheap computers. And people go, oh, yeah, I guess if they're making it in China, it must be cheap. But the fact of the matter is, you go back to David Ricardo back in 1812, or 1816, I think it was, his book or treatise on labor and the one that followed it by a year on profits. And he pointed out that the cost of something and the profit that a company makes in selling something have nothing to do or very little to do with the actual cost of labor. When companies in the United States, clothing companies, for example, started making their clothes in Malaysia or in China or in Vietnam, did you see the prices dramatically drop on tennis shoes and men's suits and women's clothing and shoes? No. I mean, certainly there is a small sector of the market, the Walmart sector at the very bottom. But by and large, no, the prices didn't go down. The profits went up. Because, as Ricardo pointed out, profits are a function of how much the market will bear, not the cost of labor. So, Gordon Brown is saying the wonderful thing from all this globalization is that our computers are cheaper. Well, frankly, I'm old enough to remember that back in the 50s and 60s, televisions became cheaper. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, would have been around 1955, 56, or maybe around 4 years old, when my family got our first television. And, an old black and white TV, because the prices were dropping. The prices were dropping not because we were outsourcing the manufacturers of television to other countries. TVs were made in the United States right up through the 70s. In large, you know, the vast majority of them, until we started changing our trade rules in the late 70s and early 80s. The reason why the price of TV was dropping was because technology was advancing. So it had nothing to do with international trade. It had to do with the invention of the transistor. It had to do with more, you know, greater demand for televisions and, you know, making more vacuum tubes and figuring out how to do more with smaller space on a circuit board. It had to do with the advancement of technology. It had nothing to do, frankly, with the cost of labor. And then the manufacturer of the TVs went overseas where the labor was much cheaper, the parts were much cheaper, and did you see the cost of TVs dramatically drop as a consequence of that? No, it just continued the steady decline. But the profits of the big companies selling them went up. So this is the tragedy of this thing. This is, and frankly, this is another reason why we should de-link, and every nation should de-link itself from this huge global system. We have handed our sovereignty over to transnational corporations. Not even the WTO although the WTO is the instrument of the transnational corporations, not even the WTO, certainly not the United Nations. We've handed our sovereignty over a few hundred transnational corporations. Every nation in the world should be, I talked about this a couple days ago, should be homeostatic, should be self-sufficient, should be able to produce its own food and, by and large, produce most of the stuff it needs. And then we can sit back and have the luxury to sit back and say, okay, we're making our own stuff, we're paying our own people, we've got a decent standard of living, whether it's the United States or whether it's Ghana. Doesn't matter. This is the fundamental rules of economics apply everywhere in the world. Once you reach that point where you are self-sustaining, then you say, now what is it that we actually need to import? And what are the things that we actually want to export? And where can we find buyers for those things that are appropriate to do that? So it's not just, let's figure out how to drive down the cost of labor so that corporate profits can go up, so a small elite, 0.1% of the ownership and management class of the world can end up a mind-bogglingly wealthy. And the cost of labor can be driven down all over the planet, ultimately, in the quest for corporate profits. I find it shocking that Gordon Brown, frankly, just laid this stuff out, and said, hey, you know, let's just turn these over to the transnational corporations. It'll be fine. It's horrific. We need some fundamental changes in this country and all around the world in the models that we're using to think about this stuff. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
In olden days, a glimpse of stocky was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. We'll be getting to your calls at the bottom of the hour, and we'll continue that throughout the rest of the day, just as an anything goes day. But first, I want to bring on Nancy Skinner, my old friend. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom Hartman.
It's great to hear from you. Let me just give a little bit of an intro for you for our listeners who may not have heard you on our program before. Skinner for Congress, by the way, .com, S-K-I-N-N-E-R, for Congress.com, the website. Nancy, you were a finance and business grad from the University of Michigan, spent most of your career pushing sustainable development. You started in radio on WLS in Chicago as one of the nation's first progressive hosts. You were nationally syndicated. You and I were both on the same network for several years, the IE America Radio Network, back before there was Air America. And then back to 1310 AM, Detroit's Progressive Talk. And you challenged Joel Nolenberg for the 9th District congressional seat, nearly won, losing by one of the narrowest margins in the country. And now you're going to finish the job in November. DemocracyForAmerica.com has a contest going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get you on because I would love to see you win this thing. DemocracyForAmerica.com. So tell us about it. Okay, your turn to talk.
You're still on the air, thank goodness, and I'm still running for office. Can you believe it, Tom? But
I think
keep getting closer. My first race was against Barack Obama.
That's right. You ran against him in the Illinois Senate primary. He beat you, and then later he endorsed you.
Absolutely. In fact, I was going through some old debate tapes. He credited me during the debates with my early and articulate opposition to the war in Iraq and endorsed me, and he and I got along very well on the campaign trail. We were so much alike, so it's thrilling to see this. And then I ran in my hometown and was just a few percentage points off, so I'm getting there. This contest you mentioned is a big deal because it's a grassroots. It's where progressives have a chance to kind of weigh in, and it's not the big machinery, and it's not the big donor. Everybody has a chance, and so it's democracyforamerica.com. It's a website, DFA. Howard Dean started that organization. His brother runs
right.
it now.
His brother Jim Dean, who's a regular on this show.
Jim's great.
Yeah, we promote Democracy for America constantly here.
Great. Well, this is our grassroots all-star contest, and I came in. Everyone can vote. It's just an online vote. You go and you give them your email and vote. And last year, I came in second place in the waning minutes of the contest. I lost out to Jerry McNerney from California, and he went on to win his congressional seat. And it was a big deal. The endorsement, I think, because I actually went and saw him as a member of Congress. I stopped in to see the guy that beat me, and he remembered me. And it ended up getting him about $100,000 in terms of endorsement money.
Yeah.
So
this
that's
is a big deal.
Huge for a vote and to get a progressive. That's the key, is to really...
Yeah, you're the real deal, Nancy. You really are. I mean, I've known you for, you know, what, 7 years,
long,
6 years?
Long time,
Yeah. And we've been on the radio together. You're the real deal. So so people can go over to democracyforamerica.com and vote for Nancy Skinner. Tell us about the race that you're in.
Well, can you just one quick thing about this. So
sure.
I'm in first place right now. I just jumped up, but I'm 25
cool.
votes out. So
okay.
what I'm going to ask people to do is to go vote, and then the voting ends on Sunday at midnight, and then the top three advance to a final round next week, and that's the runoff. So
okay.
you got to kind of keep an eye on this website and make sure that, you know, tell your friends, keep me in first place throughout the weekend, and then we'll do next week. My race, this district, obviously Michigan's hit hard. Our economy is terrible, 7.4 unemployment. Joe Nolenberg is Mr. Anti-Environment, and I spent my career
He's the Republican who's the incumbent.
Yeah, 14 years. You know, he's really a Bush, you know, ardent
Republican.
Bush supporter, absolutely. And he was the guy who penned the Nolenberg Amendment, which forbid any spending on climate change, on the Kyoto Protocol. So here I come in. I campaigned, Tom, as I've told you before, in the heart of the auto industry on global warming. Bobby Kennedy Jr. did my first ad on TV, and all my consultants said, no, you cannot run on global warming in the home of Michigan's auto industry. I said, no, you know what, that's what leadership is about. That's what courage is about. We have the ability to turn this thing around in Michigan because we can leapfrog technology. We can push this envelope and change this. So despite what all those Washington consultants told me, I did it, and I came within, it was 47-51%, and I was outspent 7-1.
Wow.
So we're back at it. You know, I have a primary now because you know how Washington, they like to recruit
sure.
people they think are a little more conservative and pliable, perhaps.
So the Democratic machine is putting a moderate up against you. Is that how it's working?
Well, you know, yeah. But I wouldn't say – I would say people are very split. I think what we're seeing is a lot of anger toward the Congress and that they weren't able to act on, and now that we have control of Congress, all that they should have. And so – you have sort of this battle going on in the Democratic Party. Do we want Paul Wellstones and Russ Feingolds and progressives who are going to stand up and do what's right? Or, you know, do we want kind of more people to get in and worry about their next election?
Right.
And so, you know, you have grassroots people. I haven't been endorsed by a number of local officials. And, you know, so there's a battle going on. A lot of women, environmental people are gunning for me. So this contest will be important because this gives everyone a chance to say, what kind of Congress do we want? It does matter what kind of Democrats. We've seen that. It matters what kind we send there.
Yeah, it does.
And,
it really
know.
Truly does. And this is all about taking back the Democratic Party. We had somebody call earlier to Bernie Sanders and said, you know, I'm thinking of not voting for Democrats. And his response and my response is, hey, voting ain't enough anymore. You got to support progressive candidates.
Absolutely.
You
so they can go
there.
To my website, Skinner4FORCongress. I got a video of me on there before the war in Iraq, asking the tough questions, Tom, and that's the kind of people that we need in office. So.
Great. Nancy Skinner, Skinner for Congress, FORCongress.com, and you can vote for her in the DFA thing over at democracyforamerica.com. Nancy, good luck and Godspeed.
Thank you. You rock, Tom.
Thanks.
Take care.
So great talking with
Bye.
You. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. I have gotten just a pile of emails, by the way, over the last 24 hours, I think, about the legacy of George W. Bush's presidency, the stats that I shared with you a day or two ago, asking where did you find those numbers and where did you forget, how could you get it. It's a Democratic caucus, Dems.gov. I put the link on our homepage on today's blog. So if you go over to TomHartmann.com and just, you know, read more on today's show, you'll find it. Real GDP growth, 4.09% over the prior 8 years, 2.65 under Bush. National debt, $5.7 trillion when he came into office, $9.2 trillion now. You know, blah de blah de blah. It goes on and on and on. So it's all right there. That and now time for...
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Our limbo alert for the day.
I'm a bigot. I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
In fact, this isn't even just our limbo alert. This is our misogyny alert for the day.
I don't care about the middle class. I'm a fat conservative, but head with the face of a horse's ass.
Okay, and that's just the beginning here. This from Rush Limbaugh's program yesterday.
She is surrounded by her good old...
Speaking, by the way, of Hillary Clinton.
She is surrounded by her good old white female... The white female...
A little more OxyContin.
New castrati male base. While her husband Bill pays penance, left to deal in South Carolina while she's up with her people. The whites and the less than blacks.
There you go. So Hillary Clinton off with her castrated base while her husband is having to pay penance by hanging out with African American. I mean, how bizarre does it get? I don't think it gets any more bizarre.
Let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the cop of Joe McCarthy.
So our limbo alert for the day, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for just playing that with regard to Limbaugh. Now I have more confidence in myself because I know Rush is marching backwards in history.
He's marching towards incoherence.
that may be too, but the point I told your caller or your screener about is basically, I don't know the answer to this, Tom, I'm just thinking about it, but are we at a paradigm shift? I mean, are nation states dying?
Well, we're not at it. I mean, it really began, you could argue, it began with Milton Friedman. There are some who would argue that it really began back in the late 1790s, early 1800s. There was a Scottish economist, I'm forgetting his name at the moment, who I think around maybe 1810, 1820 was writing about the end of the nation state and how there should be an international financial system. And in some way, and there was, you know, a lot of talk about that going back to the 1600s, frankly, the Enlightenment. And in some ways, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations in 1776, and more importantly, his theory of moral sentiments, was in opposition to that. He was arguing that a nation should only engage in international trade if it benefited that nation specifically and not if it hurt that nation. And I would argue that much trade does benefit us, but much of the trade that we engage in hurts us. Gordon Brown, rather, in his piece in the Financial Times, the last sentence of it, the last two sentences, is very telling. He says, our future prosperity, the credibility for of the multilateral system, and a chance for millions of poor people. Now, note the word millions. There are 6 billion people on planet Earth, and 5 billion of them are profoundly poor. 3 billion of them live on less than a dollar a day. So he's only talking about millions. He's talking about a small number of people.
But Tom, isn't he talking about only one tree in the forest, the economic tree?
Absolutely.
Because the thing I pointed out to your screener is basically T.X. Hamas in The Sling of the Stone is terrified of the fact that violence is no longer the monopoly of the states. You got Al-Qaeda out there, which is a non-governmental organization. You've got.
Well, I think you could argue that violence was never the monopoly of the states. During feudal times, violence was largely the monopoly of the feudal lords and the barons. And during the Gilded Age, violence was very much under the control of the big corporations. The railroads were famous for killing people who tried to form unions and things like that.
Right, but to the extent, and I'm not talking about what I would call police violence, policing violence with strikebreakers. I'm talking about, you know, tanks, airplanes, you name it, whatever the...
Well, look at we've now got private armies. I mean, you've got Blackwater in Iraq.
Precisely. And see, that's...
And in New Orleans.
And see, but that's sort of the question that I'm trying to get my mind around is you've got a whole bunch of international actors, Interpol, Doctors Without Borders, NGOs. You've got a whole bunch of what I would call stuff sloshing across borders, and I'm talking capital, expertise, and labor, and violence, and military power. I mean, we're the United States acting, but what we do in Afghanistan is we try to load it off on a whole bunch of others and call it an alliance.
Right.
And I don't think we're there. I mean, I think it sort of goes, Robert E. Lee was a Virginian, so therefore he didn't join the Union. I'm an American, so therefore I don't think highly of the United Nations. Well, I do, but Rush Limbaugh doesn't. But I'm just kind of wondering if there isn't a progression here where it's not just globalization of finance. That may be the first globalization,
right.
But if it's globalization of all of us, and at some point,
exactly.
I hope we end up, and it's going to be a rough, very rough journey, but I hope we end up thinking of ourselves not as a Virginian, not as an American, not as a North American, but as a human being.
Well, here's the problem with that, Ralph. Thinking of ourselves as human beings or thinking of ourselves as part of an interrelated ecosystem, that's entirely appropriate and a good and honest thing. But your progression, you know, I would argue that your progression was faulty, that, you know, not as a Virginian, not as an American, but instead as a citizen of the world. And the problem with that is whose world? You know, let's keep in mind that Adolf Hitler, and a lot of people bought into this early on, Adolf Hitler was promoting 1,000 years of peace worldwide. Mm-hmm. That was the promise of the Third Reich, was 1,000 years of peace. And that was the promise, frankly, of, you know, when the Catholic Church reached out in the late 1700s through the mid-1800s and controlled most of Europe. And, well, actually, long before the 1700s, I mean, was a rule of peace. I mean, that was the promise of the Ottoman Empire, was peace. And it's like, the question is, who's going to be in charge? I would argue that in fact, this whole idea of allowing American corporations, you know, going back to not just the Eisenhower administration, going back to the 19th century in a big way of, you know, reaching into third world countries and economically and politically strangling them is the, and then are saying, oh, we'll let you be like us, you know, or we'll let you, you know, use our language or use our economic systems, or we'll help you become just like us. That's the velvet glove over the iron fist of a very,
but
very
Tom,
cruel system.
Isn't that our obligation? You always end up with we the people. And isn't that what the progression has been in the United States?
And it's a bad thing. It's
No. What I'm saying is that you look at, there is no question that there are going to be power elites, money elites, and so forth. But I would posit that we, the people of the world, are freer now, 2008, than we were in 1908 or in during the Napoleonic Wars. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying it's going to, you know, it's not going to be awful. But
it depends on how you define freedom.
Yes, but we are. But see, that's the thing. We have got to get we the people worldwide to think about what's going on with we the elites who are putting us down.
Right, and that's my point. Is that every nation should be looking at their own the variables that make their nation work. You know, their own geography, their own psychology, their psychographics, whatever, their own demographics, their own all of the, you know, how do we make our nation self-sustaining? And if every nation in the world put that as their first priority, how do we elevate our own people? How do we make our nation work? And you're seeing some, I mean, the Grameen Bank, you know, micro lending, for example, in Bangladesh, some remarkable movement in very positive direction on a very, very, very local level that eliminates poverty and builds social institutions and political institutions that are highly democratic. I would suggest to you, though, that what Gordon Brown is arguing for and what the internationalists are arguing for is anti-democratic, ultimately, and that, frankly, this is the stuff that when I was a kid, and I read John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason when I was like 12 years old, and, you know, the John Birch Society book, and about how the State Department was infiltrated by communists, and you know, that year when I was 13, when I went door-to-door for Barry Goldwater in 64, that... At that time, all of the conservatives were terrified of the United Nations. They were saying the UN is going to be the one world government, and it's eventually, you know, it's going to aggregate all the police power, all the economic power in one body, and then it will be taken over by an equivalent of Adolf Hitler, and the entire world will become a monstrous place. And the fact of the matter is the UN was set up in a way that would prevent that from ever happening. The UN was set up to prevent wars, period. That was it. That was the mandate of the UN. But I would suggest to you that economic bodies that have now, as you point out, become become military bodies with private military arms like Blackwater, economic bodies like the World Trade Organization, actually represent that threat that conservatives 50 years ago were terrified of, and it's the conservatives, oddly enough, who are promoting that threat. I don't get it. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. But
we the people, Tom, have always ended up prevailing over them, the elite. And it's just worldwide now. And
that's what we've got to do. And that's exactly what I think is happening, Ralph, is that we the people are starting to wake up to the fact that we've been screwed.
Right.
And we've got to take it back. Ralph, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
That's worse when it's treated with.
Yeah, talk to us. 1-866-303-2270, our number. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our affiliated radio stations and sponsors, including the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Truer words were never spoken. 866-303-2270, our number. Chris in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I've been very interested. I want to thank you. You have a wonderful program. I listen as often as I can. The last 2 days have been particularly interesting as you contrast our economic system with other economic systems around the world. Having lived in Europe, I taught in this country, and I taught secondary in Europe as well. My wife was a nurse in Europe. We lived in Berlin. And so I've seen this around and around and around. For a very long time, we've had a chance to compare. I'll tell you, the social democracies in Europe simply work better than capitalism as it is today in America, I think.
Well, it's capitalism there. It's just a more regulated form of capitalism.
Exactly.
I lived and worked in Germany for a year, and with our three kids, we all lived there, Louise and I and our three kids, and we use their healthcare system, we use their public transportation system.
Exactly.
Things work, and we paid high taxes, and we were pleased to do so because we got incredible benefits for those taxes.
Exactly. You know, 70% of Europeans, at least Germans and most Europeans, graduate from university or vocational equivalent.
Because it's free.
The number here is 20%.
Yeah.
We're losing out on so many levels. But economically, one of the things that is hugely different is, of course, we err on the side of disclosure. So in a contract, you might have 40 pages of fine print that we call disclosure with whatever tricks might be inherent. And then in a European system, they operate on the basis of regulation. Those tricks wouldn't have even been allowed.
Right, right. Regulation as opposed to disclosure. And this is the thing. I mean, Brown is calling for disclosure. And if there's going to be regulation by the IMF, I see the IMF as frankly, that potential monster that I think Barry Goldwater thought that the UN could become.
Sure.
And there actually is a reason for nation states. There is a good reason for nation states. And all we have to remember is that the greatest despots of history, whether it was Hitler or whether it was Bonaparte or whether it was the Catholic Church during the time that it controlled most of Europe or the Ottoman Empire when it controlled much of Europe, the greatest despots in history have always claimed that they were doing it for the greater good and for peace, and they were going to try to unite the world. And it just doesn't work.
I'd like to point out one other thing, since I have a moment here.
Yes.
My whole family's been in education most of their life. One of my sisters is in international education. She accompanied Hillary Clinton to China on her educational tour.
Mm-hmm.
This last summer, my sister and one of my other sisters in education stopped by for a weekend, spent a weekend with myself, my wife, and our son. And I had to ask her, well, you know her better than anybody. Are you going to vote for her? And both of my sisters said, no, we're both going for Obama.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's the bought and sold factor.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, I'm very much trying to stay open to all three of them. The fact of the matter is the next president is going to appoint at least one and probably two, maybe even three members of the Supreme Court.
Incredibly important.
It is mind-bogglingly important. And you know, whether it's Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, obviously it's going to be one of the three. And whoever the vice presidential candidate is going to be, I'm for them. Just put it out there right now. I'm for them. My personal preference, you know, is largely John Edwards, but that's not an endorsement. It's just, I think, you know, he's probably closest to me in the positions that he's taking, and particularly his positions on poverty. But any one of those three is so much infinitely better than any of those guys that I watched last night in those Republican debates, which were just tragic to watch. Chris, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Craig in Charlottesville, Virginia, listening to WVAX. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I just want to push an issue to the forefront here that I know you talk about every day, but this is an issue that I think will give people more bang for the buck than any other issue. If we push this issue every single day to our legislators and it gets changed, it will affect every single other issue positively, and that is to get corporations out of our government. And I'm not just talking about the dinky, measly little reforms that they've attempted now.
Well, you're singing Teddy Roosevelt's song. You know, in 1907, he pushed and got passed a federal law that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to a political candidate in any way.
Yeah.
It's been diluted 38 times or so, but they still have it, actually, in Texas. It's what Tom DeLay has been indicted for.
Yeah, and if you took the corporate influence totally out of our government, every single other issue would improve or just go away.
Yeah.
And that, I think people need to be calling their legislators. I've written to both my senators here in Virginia and to my state House of Representatives.
But there's a balancing problem here, though, with that, Craig. If you just did that in a vacuum, then you would, because it still takes so much money to run for political office, and because the media has such a lock on the way that information is distributed, and they're not required to give candidates free time like they used to be, then what you would have is Michael Bloomberg's only running for political office. You'd have Mitt Romney's only running for political office. Somebody's got $100 million in their back pocket and is willing to write themselves a huge check. Romney last night wasn't even willing to talk about how much he's written.
But if you remove the corporate influence, those corporations are not going to have the influence to support
them. There are 150 million working people in the United States. Mm-hmm. Out of our population, 300 million, about 125 to 150 million of us draw a paycheck. If every one of us put $5 a year, or let's say $10. Let's get grandiose. $10 a year into a federal election fund. That's $1.5 billion a year. 150 million times $10 is $1.5 billion a year. That's enough money. Certainly, and I mean that would be $3 billion every 2 years, $6 billion every 4 years, presidential elections. That's enough money to say, okay, we're now going to have public funding of elections, and we're going to let the people decide. I mean, this is what they're doing in Arizona, and it's working. It's what they're doing. It's what we're doing here in Portland, Oregon. It's working. It's what they're doing in Maine, and it's working. There are other states that are seriously looking at this. And we're talking. I mean, last night, one of the Republicans said, "Oh, and my God, we wouldn't certainly want." Don't want me to pay for it. And I think it was the commentary afterwards. I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah, I want to pay for it.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here. By the way, we had a winner yesterday, and I just so got into what was going on yesterday, forgot to mention it on the air. We had a contest yesterday for the best comment posted on our blog over at TomHartman.com, just right there on the homepage, you know. And Glenn Lab was the winner. His comment was, I just realized I owe George Bush an apology. It seems he's not the Antichrist because, according to the Book of Revelations, the Antichrist will only rule for 7 years. And so Glenn Lab wins an autographed copy of Cracking the Code, my new book. And I put a note on the blog yesterday saying, Glenn Lab, send me your postal address information so I can send it to you. Email it to me at tom@tomhartman.com and all that kind of thing. And we'll get it going. Sarah in Burbank, California. You're on the air, Sarah. What's on your mind today?
Yes. Hi, Tom. I heard you say, I think it was last week, that you were confused about the fact that Dennis Kucinich did not throw his Iowa second ballot votes to John Edwards.
No, I never said I was confused. I said when he did it, he lost me. That was the phrase I used.
Right. Sorry to use the wrong word there. I realize you're never confused.
No, I'm often confused, but just for the sake of clarity.
Anyway. Yeah, you don't seem confused. Anyway, I misspoke. I got an email from Dennis explaining why he did that. He said that John Edwards had connections to Fortress Investment Group, which is a Wall Street hedge fund, and that he had made $500,000 in a year from attending a few meetings with Fortress, and has invested a substantial part of his own personal wealth in Fortress,
mm-hmm.
whose portfolios are responsible for predatory lending practices, Medicare privatization, and an entire range of corporate sharp dealings that are driving the middle class into poverty.
I don't believe it.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. I just don't believe it.
Well, I don't know whether to believe it or not.
I believe that John Edwards is invested in Fortress. I mean, wealthy people, John Edwards has got a couple million bucks. He's not super rich, but he's got a couple million bucks. And he's putting that money where it's going to get a good return. And, I'm not going to criticize him for that. And it may well be a hedge fund. It may well be Fortress. But I don't believe that that's the reason why Dennis said, go to Obama, because this should be about governance and how, and the positions people are taking. But in any case, it's all a moot point now. Dennis Kucinich has dropped out of the race.
I was just wondering why.
But I got that email also from Dennis's campaign because I've donated money to his campaign. It went out to everybody. And, I don't buy it. But that's just me. Sarah, thanks a lot for trying to clarify that, though. I appreciate it. Let's see, 866-303-2270. Nick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You want to disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line.
Hi, Tom. It's a disagreement in the form of an alternate proposal regarding the economic stimulus package. What we need to do as Americans out here, we need to find ways to empower ourselves and give us more leverage against the government. So what I'm proposing, and I've called many of the congressional...
Now, hang on just a second here, Nick. Wait a second.
Go ahead.
Why is it that you are afraid of government when it is not the power of government that is keeping you from having access to national health care, to having inexpensive health care, when it's not power of government that is poisoning foods, that is polluting the air? I mean, I'm far more concerned about the power of corporations in our culture right now than I am the power of government.
Well, because I'm not afraid of the power of government, but I'm just thinking we need more leverage in government.
I think we need a louder voice in government. The part of, when it's so odd, the Republicans talk about big government that they want to destroy, but they're not talking about the big brother part of government, that wants to listen in on our phone conversations and keep records of all of our email conversations and know where we all go and give us IDs so that they can scan a crowd from a quarter mile away and instantly know the identity of everybody in that crowd if they're protesting. The conservatives don't complain about that part of big government. They complain about this minute, tiny fraction of big government that is taking care of people in poverty and handicapped people and that kind of thing. I mean, I just find it bizarre. And
all that taken into consideration and all that aside at the same time, as far as the stimulus package is concerned, I'm offering a proposal where they exempt people from their withholdings in their paychecks. Okay, give us the money back that way. Don't take it from us in the first place. That's what I see as the problem been all along. They've been taking the money and taking the money and taking the money. Okay,
I get it, Nick. Here's what's so seductive about that. And here's what's wrong with that. What's so seductive about it is, I'll bet you're thinking that let's say you make 50 grand a year. I have no idea what you make, but just for sake of argument. And,
sure.
and that you're paying $20,000 a year in taxes out of that.
Sure.
Just to pull numbers out of the air.
Right.
You're figuring that if the government doesn't take that 20 grand a year, you're going to end up with $50,000 a year in your pocket, right?
Well, yeah, you're going to take your gross pay home.
Right. Now let me just follow this for a second. Your employer knows that you're paying $20,000 a year in taxes on that $50,000 a year gross paycheck.
Okay.
They know that you are taking home $30,000 at the end of the year. Do you think for 1 minute that if the taxes went away, that your employer would not reduce your pay to $30,000 since they already know that that's what you're willing to work for?
Well, wait a minute. It should only be between us and the government taking our taxes.
But it's not. It's the money is coming from your employer, and you're talking about a marketplace, a labor marketplace that is a relatively free labor marketplace in the United States.
Okay.
And what will happen if you dramatically drop taxes is you're going to see a dramatic drop in the cost of labor. In other words, in what people are willing to pay for labor. And frankly, that's actually what we've seen since Reagan dropped the top rate of taxes, is you've seen a drop in the cost of labor. The employers say, oh, yeah, well, this guy, he's willing to work for $30,000 a year, and they cut his taxes from $20,000 down to $10,000, so now he's making $40,000 a year. So I'm going to say, you know, hey, Charlie, your benefits are going to be cut to the tune of $10,000. Now you're on your own. We're no more pension plan. It's a 401k, and it's half of what it was, and we're going to double the deductibles on, you know, they do it in sneaky ways. They don't actually cut your pay. They reduce your benefits because that's part of what it costs them to employ you. But the bottom line is they know that you're willing to work for $30,000 a year, to use this example. And no matter what your taxes are, you know, if your taxes go up, if the government says, okay, we're going to raise your taxes from $20,000 to $30,000, so you're only taking home $20,000 a year on that $50,000, at that point, your employer is in a position where they're going to, you know, and you are in a position where you're going to be saying, you know, I'm sorry, I can't work for you anymore for this kind of pay. You're going to have to pay me more. And your employer is going to have to say, yeah, you're right, here's $60,000 a year. That's what Alan Greenspan refers to as wage inflation, and he gets all hysterical about it. He thinks it's the only kind of inflation to worry about.
I see it where that we should just be able to get what our gross pay is. The employer should not be able to say you're willing to work for less or this or that.
But that's how it works.
But
there is a market for labor.
But there has to be a point in time where we say, no, that's not how it's going to work anymore. This is what I think we lost.
Oh, this is how it's worked for 10,000 years. I mean, from the earliest agricultural economies, this has always been how it's worked. And the people who are the employers have always been looking for ways to have power and control over the people who are the employees. And the only way that the employees, that individual workers, can have any ability to push back against the power of aggregated capital, of great wealth, or great, you know, power, the power that comes with great wealth, is by organizing, and that's the union movement.
Well, okay, all that takes.
Which brought us the 2-day weekend and the 40-hour week. And
yeah, I'm not disparaging any of that or anything like that. It's just in my mind here at this point, I think to myself, is that, wait a minute, if we just say to the government, you know, we have to get some kind of control here over their spending. And how that seems to be a critical part of all this.
If you want to get control over the spending of the government, for example, I think it's insane that the United States spends more on defense than all other countries in the world combined. We are definitely not getting our bang for the buck. The fact that the Pentagon has lost $2 trillion and can't account for it. $2 trillion and can't account for it. That they lost in Iraq $6 billion, enough money that you could see it from the moon. I agree with you. There's something seriously wrong. Do you want to see, but that kind of spending is not what the Republicans are talking about when they're talking about getting control of government. If you want to get control of government, then elect progressives to office. Get out there and work for their campaigns. Send 25, 50 bucks to their campaigns. Go door to door for their campaigns. Show up at Democratic Party meetings, Green Party meetings, Republican Party meetings. Take back the political system. It's not enough to just vote. But I'm telling you, this panacea of, oh, let's just cut our taxes and somehow we'll all have more money. It ain't never going to happen, because when you reduce the costs of having an employee, or when you increase the revenue available, the employers will simply cut the pay or cut the benefits to you, because they know what you're willing to work for. They know the market of labor has established a point of equilibrium, Nick. It has. It always has. It always does. And that's why unions get in there, is to change that equilibrium point. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Già se nacciu su su sale fonghi di dale da. Anything goes. One quasi se se in the desert.
And welcome back. Anything goes. Friday, 21 minutes past the hour. Let me just finish that. The logic on this riff that Nick and I were having, you know, he was basically saying, hey, cut my taxes, I'll have more money. And I was saying, no, if we were to dramatically or even incrementally cut your taxes, your employer will simply cut back your payer benefits because they know what you're willing to work for. This is why in Europe, and I say this not just from as an observer, but as somebody who actually lived and worked in Europe, why taxes are dramatically higher than they are here in the United States. About half of my entire paycheck when I was living in Germany was going to taxes, and pay was higher. You end up at the end of the day with the same amount of money in your pocket. A German worker ends up at the end of the day with the same amount of money in their pocket after taxes as an American worker or a French worker or a Swiss worker. The difference is that the gross pay is higher. In other words, the corporations are having to pay a higher percentage. They're having to pay higher salaries in order to get those workers, and that money then goes into the taxes, which then goes into a national health care system and a good social service and a social safety net system. Number one. So number one, no, you will not see an increase in the money in your pocket if taxes go down if you're spending 100% of your income. Now, if you are one of the lucky few, the roughly 5% or, you know, somewhere, some argue it's as small as 3% of Americans who don't spend 100% of their income, but actually have a lot of their, after their income, have a lot of money left over. If you're part of that 0.1% that makes over $1 million a year, the 0.01% that makes over $10 million a year, then yes, if you have a tax cut, because your employer is not paying you at the market, if you have a tax cut, you're going to end up with more money in your pocket. But and this is also, by the way, why when Bill Clinton raised taxes, what happened? Wages went up. Remember the prosperity after Clinton raised taxes? Why, when FDR raised taxes, what happened? It got us out of the Great Depression. Wages went up. We built the biggest industrial infrastructure the world had ever seen. When JFK raised taxes, yes, he dropped the marginal tax rate from 91% to 71%, but he closed so many loopholes, the effect was a tax raise, and he ran. He campaigned on raising taxes. You've heard that audio clip on this show. When he raised taxes, wages went up. Prosperity increased. It's like people in America don't get it because we've had almost 30 years now of these right wingers saying, if we cut your taxes, you'll end up with more money. And it's only true for the top 3%. It's not true for you and me. It's not true for anybody who spends 100% or more or less of what they make. If you are a wage earner, if you are spending the money that you make, in other words, you're at a certain standard of living. That's where you're living, and your employer is paying you based on that. You're willing to work based on that. Cutting your taxes is not going to mean extra money in your pocket for more than a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Certainly not more than a year. That's about how long it'll take the market to simply recalibrate itself. It's real, real simple. Let's get back to our phone calls here. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number. Phil in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hey, Phil. You want to disagree with me?
Well, sort of. I'm a big fan of your show, and I agree with you most of the time. But on this same issue, I think the average American does not understand what you're saying. I think you're probably right on that. But when they hear you say raise taxes, that's all they hear is you're going to raise. Democrats are going to raise taxes. I think it needs to be, you know, a better way of wording things, maybe to get people to vote for the
yeah, like increased prosperity.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact of the matter, you know, I think I love this slogan. You know, I would love to have the Clinton tax rate if it brought me the Clinton economy. You know, I mean, it's just a great slogan. You know, the taxes were higher under Bill Clinton. The economy worked under Bill Clinton. But you're right. We need to figure out a way to frame that or unframe the way that the Republicans have framed it. And perhaps we can have a collective think tank here on it. We can all think about it. The folks in the chat room can toss in suggestions. People can put it over at our blog and people can call in. But I think your point is well said. Ryan in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind today? Ryan, you are on the air.
Ryan?
Yes, sir.
All right. I was actually wondering about Ron Paul. I just tuned into you guys for the last couple days, but I haven't heard anybody talk about Ron Paul, about getting rid of the Federal Reserve and stuff like that. How do you think that would help our economy?
Boy, it's a tough one. The Federal Reserve, you know, Ron Paul and the largely libertarians and conservatives who argue against the existence of the Fed, and it's not that liberals like it. It's that, you know, it's just not an issue that has come onto the radar of the Democratic Party or liberals by and large. I think it should, frankly, but it hasn't been. But, you know, the point is that the Fed, it's a privately owned bank. It's a federally chartered, but it's a corporation. The Fed is owned by the 10 or 12 regional banks, which then in turn are owned by smaller banks. And you can actually buy stock in the Fed by buying stock in an FDIC bank. But the Fed has certainly dramatically diluted the value of our money. It's just that, I mean, this was the struggle throughout the 18th and early 19th century in the United States, or the entire 19th century in the United States, is what do you replace it with? I mean, we had a national bank twice in the 1800s, and it crashed our economy both times.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make very much.
See, that's the problem. I don't have an alternative solution, Ryan, and until I see a good one, I don't know.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I'm going to show you how to take control. Got to vote, yeah, you know how it goes. But y'all looking for the cars and clothes. And this other man hope is that y'all don't vote. Because even he know majority rules. Keep majority of the minority fooled. Your vote really does matter, dude. And that attitude, government's loving it. So you're looking for your retribution. Be part of the problem or the solution. Really, all due respect, kid. Voting is free, last time I checked it. Look at he crooked and he connected. You don't vote, then he getting reelected. See, I'ma tell him in the style.
34 minutes past the hour. Amy sends me a note. She says, applying Lakoff's logic, I would say the taxes should be framed as investing in our communities. That's a good point. By the way, our program brought to you today in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199. Fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right and not a privilege. Yeah, I think taxes, instead of calling them taxes, this is what we used to call it. We used to have, for example, in communities, we used to have votes on whether or not we would invest in a new school. And it wasn't a vote on whether we were going to raise our taxes. It was a vote on whether we were going to float a bond to invest in the school. Everybody understood it meant that, you know, taxes were going to go up a tenth of a penny or something like that. You know, this number of mils or that number of mils. But it was always until Reagan came along referred to as investment. Because it was an investment. And that's why since Reagan, since we stopped investing in America, we now have a 30 or 26, 27-year history now of virtually no investment in our infrastructure, and you have bridges collapsing in Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, Minneapolis and St. Paul. You have schools that are crumbling all over the United States. You've got just an infrastructure crisis, water systems that don't work, septic systems, sewer systems that don't work. America needs to be rebuilt. And we're spending $120 billion a year rebuilding Iraq? And that's how much Bush is going to use to stimulate the U.S. economy, the exact same amount of money as a year in Iraq? I don't get it. Well, I do get it, and that's what's wrong. You know, it is so wrong. Josh in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Josh.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey there. I just wanted to dispute the small section that you have in the framing chapter of your book, Cracking the Code. In there, you have two stories, one of your friend from Vietnam who committed suicide, and of the two little boys, one who shot the other because the dad left the gun safe unlocked.
Right.
And I just wanted to point out that two things. A, I don't think we should blame the object of the tragedy. If someone were to, you know, kill someone else with a rock, I certainly wouldn't blame the rock. And secondly, I wanted to point out that I think education is the key here. For example, my kids have grown up around firearms. I leave firearms around the house pretty much fully loaded almost all the time just because I work on them and those kinds of things. And my kids understand that they're tools, not toys.
But their friends don't.
And I've created an environment in my house where they are commonplace rather than keeping them hidden and making them kind of a mystery or a taboo or some kind of exciting item.
Well, Josh, that's exactly why so many kids die in the United States every year by accidental gunshot wound is because parents think that, you know, hey, my kids are well-educated. I mean, I've taken my kids to shooting ranges. And, you know, I'm a member of the NRA. One of my three brothers, my brother Steve, I go back to Michigan, you know, for fun. What we do, you know, as two brothers is we go down to the shooting range and do target practice, you know, competitive target practice. I understand that. And I'm not, you know, some, you know, let's do away with all the guns guy. But the fact of the matter is that something like mandating trigger locks, just saying, you know, if you're going to sell something that is designed unlike a rock, you know, a piece of stone you can use for a whole bunch of different things. You could use it to build a wall. You can use it to build a driveway. You can, you know, it can be decorative.
Sure.
Guns are designed to kill people or to kill other things. And, you know, pure and simple. So they have to have some safety mechanism built into them. And to simply say that, you know, the gun industry, if you're going to sell a gun, it has to come with a trigger lock on it that is easy to use, you know, so that it will have a high probability of being used, or you know, even mandating that sort of thing, and that there are certain people in our society that we don't want to have guns, and that we should be able, and that individual communities should be able to determine, based on their own community, what their gun laws are going to be. When I lived in Vermont, I could carry a loaded firearm with no permit whatsoever. When I lived in Georgia, when I went through the Georgia Police Academy and got licensed as a private detective, I had to have a carry permit in order to carry a weapon. Here in Oregon, frankly, I don't know. I'm assuming that it's the same. I don't have a handgun. And in New York City, Washington, D.C., my understanding is I'd have to jump through 1,000 hoops in order to get a weapon. I mean, every community should be able to make their own decisions about what they want to have in that community. But the point of that chapter was just that these should be decisions that are being made collectively in the context of what's the best thing for we the people as a society, not just some, you know, blind bowing down to the Second Amendment that was actually put in place as part of a dispute over whether or not we should have a standing army during times of peace.
And I don't want to do that either. I mean, there's certain firearms, for example, that I think just should not be available to the public, certain military firearms.
Yeah, like surface-to-air missiles.
Right.
Or 50-millimeter machine guns, or 50-millimeter single-shot rifles. Who needs to put a bullet through a quarter inch of steel?
Yeah, nobody does. But you know, I certainly have a good time going out and shooting potatoes in cans. But,
yeah, and I love going to the range and firing off, you know, on a 30-clip or a 50-clip Uzi. It's great fun. But you know, that's under a regulated circumstance.
Sure, sure. I also wanted to just say one quick story, because you mentioned at the very beginning of that chapter, you have a story about a woman who defended herself from a mugger or a carjacker or something like that. And I wanted to mention that my father-in-law did, in fact, fend off a mugger with his firearm, and it was a white guy, for the record, not a black guy. So, and that was in downtown Seattle. And all he did was brandish his weapon, and that was it.
Yeah, for people who don't know the book that we're talking, this is my book, Cracking the Code. It's about, you know, framing political messages, and I talked about how there's this vanishing hitchhiker story, this meme, anybody who is totally anti-gun control will say, oh, I know of some guy, you know, who a black guy tried to carjack a woman. It's almost always a black guy and a white woman in a supermarket parking lot kind of thing. And they always know somebody who, and then you ask, well, who was that person? Well, actually, I know somebody who knows somebody. Well, who was that person? Well, I don't, and it's like this cultural mythos that we have. You know, the reality is that I'm sure a lot of crimes have been stopped by people having firearms. On the other hand, a lot of people are killed by firearms. As I tell the story, my best friend Clark Stinson, when I was 20 years old, shot himself intentionally, tragically, my plea is for rationality in this.
Exactly, but even with your friend that committed suicide, there's other. I mean, he could have just as easily, you know, walked in front of a moving car or hung himself, jumped off a bridge, whatever. You know, I mean, if he was really bound and determined to commit suicide, anybody, you know, could.
If he was, yeah. But knowing Clark, my guess is that the easy availability of the gun and the depression that he was experiencing, he had just come back from for basic training, and it was the Christmas holiday, and he was just really bummed out, and it was just an easy thing to grab that gun and put it in his mouth. And, you know, but again, that doesn't argue for eliminating firearms. That argues for a whole bunch of other things. But, you know, Josh, your point is taken, and I hope I've responded to it. We need to move along here. Jay in San Diego, California. Hey, Jay, you also want to disagree. So.
Yes, hi. I wanted to disagree with you about the idea of framing the argument of taxes. And what I think we really need to do is educate people that we've had for too long the idea that taxes are evil. And, you know, to quote the famous quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, taxes are what we pay for a civilized society.
They're the price of admission for
That's
a civilized
right.
society.
And we need to, people really have to understand that this isn't some horrible thing that the government, I mean, yes, sometimes they're spent in ways that we don't always like Iraq, you know, the example you cited. But I'm in California, and we're facing a huge budget problem here, and I'm working with my local PTA to try to get some local parent involvement because, for example, the school that my kids go to, we're looking at a cut of, at the current rate that Schwarzenegger's proposing, when you build in the state and then the federal matching fund, could be $472,000 lost out of next year's budget for the school. I mean, that's a hit, a horrible hit for any school. And people talk a lot about, you know, oh, well, it's not a, the problem is it's a spending problem, not a income problem. And I'm looking at some figures here from the Public Policy Institute of California, and it's really fascinating to break down where the money goes. And, for example, to actually run the government itself, you might say the administrative thing, portion of it, it's only 7% of the budget. For environmental spending, it's only 1%. For transportation, it's only 2%. And so there's just not this idea of there's not this big amount of fat that you can cut out of the budget. The reality is we live in an advanced society. We have advanced needs. We got to fix our roads. We want to educate our kids to compete in the workforce. We want to protect our water sources, et cetera. And it costs money. And people have to understand that they got to pay in to get out.
Yeah, if you want to have a commons. Yeah, if you want to have a commons, you want to use the commons, then you've got to pay for the commons. It's yep. it's really that simple. And I think you're paraphrasing Oliver Wendell Holmes that the taxes are the cost of admission to a civil society is very well said, Jay. And that's frankly, you know, a phrase that I recall learning in civics class in junior high school. And I went to junior high school in the 60s. I don't think anybody has, I just frankly, since the purges of the Reagan years, which are still ongoing under David Horowitz in the colleges now. Now they're trying to purge the college professors. But, you know, the purges of the textbooks and whatnot back in the 80s of you know, communism is being taught, these civics classes. I don't think, you know, I just don't think that these issues are even being discussed among our kids these days. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to all the great people who helped make this program work this week. To David Poole, Louise Hartman, Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Marcus Hillman over at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website over at tomhartman.com, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service will be with us in just a second. First, Ray in Shirley, New York, you had a quick story you wanted to share with us. Ellen is waiting. About an activism story.
Hello?
Hey, Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First, I'd like to thank you for the good work you do for all of us. And I'd like to tell you in America that one person can make a difference. My son died because he had no health care and they didn't health insurance and they didn't take care of him. So we lobbied here in New York, all the politicians and whatnot, and we made it stink and we continued to make it stink and we kept hitting brick walls, but we kept insisting and insisting and insisting, and P.S., we got Manny's Law passed that prevents them from not taking care of individuals here in New York State.
That's great. That's great.
So one
and
person
Manny,
can
Manny,
make a difference.
Manny was your son?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear of your loss, Ray, and I am so proud of you, so pleased that you used that loss to create something good for all the other children in New York State. That's great. Good on you.
Yeah, my son now is saving lives, so he didn't die in vain.
Amen. Congratulations, Ray. Thank you very much for the call today.
Thank you.
And for sharing your story with us. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com, their new and improved website with all kinds of cool news. It looks great, Ellen.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we worked on it hard and more improvements to come. Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi spoke at the press club today, and they divided it up between sort of international and national issues. I got to tell you, Harry Reid outdid himself. He was excellent. He first invoked FDR, and then he said we have 158,000 people in Iraq, and Osama bin Laden remains free. He talked about al-Qaeda getting stronger. He said there was the most effective way to harness our power was economically, militarily, and morally. He said we can start by announcing America does not torture. We can close Guantanamo. He said we only have a crew of 7,000 people working through our State Department. He said that's about the size of one aircraft carrier. And he said the promises of President Bush on the Peace Corps have gone unfulfilled. That Cuba and Venezuela send teachers and doctors all over the Southern Hemisphere. We have to work on energy and appearance. He said there is not one single non-deployed brigade that is capable of active duty today. He said combat is wearing out $1 billion dollars a month in vehicles, PTSD, one out of every six people. We need a new GI Bill. He said the president squandered, and he used that word, an opportunity to bring the world together after 9/11. He also talked about that they ought to double the number of intelligence officers hunting for bin Laden and talked about Iranian diplomacy. It was really quite a speech.
Wow. Was he taking questions as well, or did he just give a speech?
I actually had to leave to take the train after there were questions, but I listened to him and Pelosi and
right.
took off.
Okay.
Nancy Pelosi talked about the 100 million reporters and their reporters. I'm reading my own handwriting notes pretty badly, that the 100 million people that are going to be saved by this new bill that is happening, that this is going to 100 million families are going to be saved. But she also talked about
you're talking about the economic stimulus package.
Yes,
saved by $600.
Right, she said.
I think that's a little bit of an overstatement, don't you think?
I was not pleased about that, but she did say that they had increased the minimum wage. Her speech was definitely not as strong. Increased in research and development. She said they cut student loans in half, but then she got a little stronger and she said there's $5.5 billion in cancer research. That's only 2 weeks worth of money in Iraq. She said we need infrastructure investment, and she said about one day in Iraq could give 1,000 NIH research grants, and also 1 week in Iraq could give 400,000 scholarships for education in a public university. So
yeah,
they were hit pretty strong.
This is how we need to start framing these expenses. You save $20 billion and people go, what's that? You know.
Right.
But if you say, okay, a week in Iraq is how many? Is what?
A week in Iraq is 300, a day in Iraq is 330 million, and then you can multiply that times 2 point something billion.
Right. Right. But, I mean, translating it into the number of teachers that we could hire, the number of cops we could put on the streets, the number of, you know, schools we could be building, the number of highways we could be rebuilding, the infrastructure that we could, public transportation systems that we could put in.
Exactly. A couple other interesting things. John Boehner is the Republicans are having their conference. The president is helicoptered over there today. John Boehner said that basically they're going to focus on earmarks. This is how they're going to look like the Reform Party. Good luck to them. If that's their Reform Party, I got news for them. I interviewed Debbie Stabenow, Senator Stabenow from Michigan last night. She said in the Senate part of the bill that the House agreed to in terms of the stimulus package, they're going to try and increase food stamps and increase unemployment benefits. And also our friend Mr. Mukasey said that he is hopeful that the Senate will take up the FISA action next week.
Interesting.
Again,
my understanding is that Monday they want to vote on this thing before the State of the Union address to give Bush and his cronies both within the White House and in the phone company's immunity that they're going to try and get that done. Another reason to be calling the Senate today, go to callcongress.org and get one of the toll-free numbers and call your two senators and tell them no. Because the vote hasn't happened on the final bill itself.
No, it has not.
Right. Okay. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up Monday, I'll be challenging Alex Epstein on profits over people in a broken health care system, and George Bush is going to address his State of the Union, or put together his State of the Union address. We'll talk about the State of the Union. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. See you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.